And open with all you being rising, you will also be able to mirror that. It's actually that story of the first Wesa which I went to. And the Baptist Brothers Benefice, who came back to Cambridge, it's our Cambridge Book Society in Wesa. And I thought it would be so easy to become one. This all you need is the resolution. You will go and turn to dust like that dry up. I won't leave my seat, I said. So I had to get all right. I was in a hurry, the young man. It's much harder than that. But actually, much more fun as well. Because the path of meditation, the path to enlightenment, is a lot more happiness. For those of you who remember the Samadhipala Sutta, it was a great sutra of the Buddha, where King Ajatasattu went to see the Lord Buddha, and they talked of happiness. Basically, the king was saying, "Now you're a prince, why do you do this? Why do you become a bhikkhu? You could be enjoying the pleasures of the senses in the palace." And the Buddha said, "The pleasure is king, you don't know what pleasures are. I can sit for 7 days with immense pleasure which doesn't move. Can you do that?" And the king realized the pleasures of an enlightened one far exceed the pleasures of the king. And we're told about the pleasures of the holy life. Just by going for refuge is a great pleasure. Keeping the precepts that raises your average happiness level way up there. People who keep precepts are happier. When you start to restrain your senses, your happiness is going into orbit. When you get into meditations and jhanas, you're getting happiness which is literally out of this world. And you get the enlightenment happinesses. That really is peace. All these people take ecstasy pills. Monks take ecstasy, breathing in, breathing out. Oh, he said this. Here's the first question. Does a Sota Panasya, is a Sota, sorry, Sota Panasya unbroken? Can it break more than once? What does it mean to break the sphere? It does mean that they can transgress the 5 precepts. But they don't break the sphere, if you know what I mean. In other words, for the sphere, the underlying virtue is always very strong. But sometimes it manifests as not keeping what we keep thinking of the 5 precepts. Remember the 5 precepts are an approximation for sphere movements. Real sila is not doing anything which harms another being. Not doing anything which harms oneself and understanding what those actually mean. Living a harmless, beautiful, peaceful life. But technically speaking, what appears to others is a stimulus breaking precepts. Then they make an entire full thing breaking again. Because we're still in a their acts of body and speech are yet to be perfected, but their understanding is pure. It's just their bodily activities have to be brought into line with their understanding. It's similar to a person who knows that smoking is bad for your health. They know they should give it up, but they can't quite do it yet. It's only a short matter of time. Venerable sir, do the devas protect the virtuous even without prayers for devas? Of course they do. Do you want to hear devas stories now? Here's a devas story. By far the best devas story. That's actually not by far, this is just one out of many. But the most well documented devas story. I'm sure I told this last time I was in Sri Lanka. We concerned this young man, an American man, who was in Thailand working for the Peace Corps, having completed his 2 years in the Peace Corps. Before going back to the United States, he thought he would like to ordain as a bhikkhu. In Thailand, there was, still is, such a thing as temporary ordination. He was actually interested he may stay a long time or a short time, but he thought he'd wanted to give it a try. he'd experienced the Buddhist culture in Thailand and respected it and wanted to come a bit closer to it by ordaining. But how do you become a monk, he thought. He was staying in a hotel on the edge of Bangkok. So he asked the concierge, who usually only knows the way to massage parlors and bars. So he asked the concierge, I want to become a monk, how do you do that? And the concierge is not the most informed of people who knows about how to become a monk. But he did know there was a monastery, a temple in the center of Bangkok, which is called Wat Pho Wong. And the concierge had seen that many Western monks had actually ordained there. So he said, that's the place you should go. Yes, but who do I see and what do I say? The concierge said, well, get some food. Go early in the morning, and then you can put some food in one of the monks' bowls when they come out on the armstone. And then you can ask them, you know, a little bit of time, ask them if you want to be a monk, and they will help you. And that's not the way it's done. But nevertheless, that's what he thought the procedure was. So he arranged for some food, got a taxi early in the morning, and went to that temple. However, for him, early in the morning was about 4 a.m. And the temple was all locked up. He got the time terribly wrong. He had the food there, and there was no one around. He was walking up and down, wondering what to do next. But soon he saw a man, and the man actually was coming up to him and asked him what he was doing, walking up and down outside the temple. And this man spoke perfect English. And so the American could tell him that he'd been in the Peace Corps for 2 years, now he wanted to become a monk. The concierge had told him this is what he should do. So here he is. And the layman said, it's far, far too early. The monks won't be coming out for another hour and a half yet. But never mind, said the man, I'm attendant to the monastery. I'll let you inside, come inside. So he took out some keys and opened the gate. And the two of them walked in. And then right in front of the gate is a main, they call it in Thailand, Upotita Hall. It's the hall where they do all the main ceremonies and where they do the ordinations. Now this temple is a royal temple. In that hall, the kings of Thailand are ordained temporarily. Every king has to spend a short time as a monk in that temple. So the man got the keys out, opened the main door of the temple, turned on the lights, and proceeded for the next hour or more to give this American man a guided tour around the temple, pointing out all of the murals which were painted on the wall, and explaining in detail what they meant, and also who sponsored them and why. It was a fascinating exposition of those temple paintings. Now, you may have seen similar paintings. And sometimes in the Thai artistic tradition, it's very hard to figure out what they are. Even if you know the Tao and the Tales and other stories in the life of the Buddha. Because in one frame, there's many different pictures with different chronological order. They don't have the pictures like in a linear sequence, like in cartoons. Different events happen at different times, but part of the same story. It's all in one frame. So I have difficulty sometimes understanding the sequence and what it all means. But this man did everything. And after giving him the guided tour of this temple, the man said, it's about time now the monks will be coming out. There's one monk, he's a senior monk, he comes out about this time and he just stands right over there. This is what the monk looks like. Wait for him, put your food in the bowl and tell him you want to become a monk. He's the one you should see. Thank you so much for being so kind, said the American, as the temple attendant closed up. And sure enough, a few moments later, an old monk came out, he was one of the senior monks. And the American put some advice on his bowl and asked him to become a monk. the old man said, can you wait here? I've just been back from Mum's van in about 20 minutes and I'll take him inside and start him off. And that's what happened. But unfortunately, that training to be a monk, there's many things you have to learn, not just the ordination procedure or the chanting, but some of the basic rules. You have to be trained. And a monk they assigned to train him did not speak clear English. So the American made a complaint. They were having terrible difficulties training this monk. Can't you find someone else who can speak English more clearly? And they said, this is the best we have. We don't have anyone who speaks English better than me. But the American said, what about a temple attendant I met on the first day? He spoke perfect English. And that's when they asked, what temple attendant? What are you talking about? The temple attendant who let me in and showed me the main hall. When they heard that, they dragged him to see the abbot. Because there is no temple attendant. Certainly not one with those kitties. And that particular gate, I know it well. I've been living in Thailand for 9 years. In Wat Pawat, that is called the King's Gate. Only the King of Thailand or the royal family are allowed to pass through that gate. It's a tradition. No lay person has the keys to the temple. That's getting a couple of months. You can't even turn electricity on at that place. Instead, he saw the man flip the switch. So they dragged him to the abbot, who is now the Sangharaja of Thailand. And the Sangharaja of Thailand was listening to the story and stopped this American here and said, stop. Because he called for his secretary to write this down. Little by little, they wrote down the whole story of a temple attendant who just does not exist, who can speak perfect English, who can open a door when no one has the keys except the monks. And only they wouldn't allow anyone to go through to them themselves. That's the king's bed. Who can turn on electricity where it can't be turned on, open doors, hasn't got a key. And even the old abbot did not know all the history of those paintings. That was new to him, who sponsored these and why. And then when the American finished his story about a strange person who opened doors you can't open, knew things that no one knew now, because that temple was about 150 years old, they asked him, what did he look like? He described a man in old traditional Thai dress. But what did his face look like? Now it's very difficult to describe a person's face. Especially if it's a person of a different ethnic race. So the poor American was trying to scratch himself, trying to think what he looked like. And as he was trying to think, he saw on the wall a picture. My goodness, it's him! He recognized the man who had opened these gates, because his picture was on the wall. It was a photograph of a photograph, a painting of King Mokhut. King V of Thailand, who had been one of the main sponsors of that monastery. A king long dead. Now the neighbor saw a young man with an aspiration to be a monk and came down to open doors which cannot be opened, to explain things which have been long forgotten, to help a noble aspirant. Just like in the days of the Buddha, when Yasa went forth, where the day was also open gates in the town which should have been locked, which made lights so he could find his way in the dark. Such things happen today. That is a well-known story in the history of that temple. And I know that no one ever tells the religious. The rabbi is 100% thinking as his own was learning Davis Law. That's inspiring. Yes. It's a true day. Now I'll tell you my Davis Law. Be interesting. I don't think we've got time. Should we go to the next question? I'm just playing with you. I know you have that story. For those of you who've read some of the books of the Forest Monks in Thailand, you'll know the story of a monk called Ajahn Chah. This is his favorite story, but it relates to mine, which has come out of this. During the Second World War, this monk, Ajahn Chah, was meditating in Burma. Remember, in those days, the monks could walk backwards and forwards in all Buddhist countries, and there was no need for passports, nor did you need any travel certificates, so just had to roll. You'd find food wherever you went in Buddhist countries in those days. So he was happily meditating in a monastery in Burma. However, when the Second World War came out, the Thailand capitulated to the Japanese and joined them. So the Thais were the enemies of the British. And any Thai which was found in British Burma was subject to interrogation, imprisonment. And the British thought that those Thai monks were spies. So they would kill many of those Thai monks. It was wartime, and people do see things like that. I'm now making amends for the sins of some of my ancestors. So the Burmese laicus of this monk told him, look, it's too dangerous for you to remain in Burma. If British soldiers come, they will probably kill you. You have to escape. But of course, the British soldiers were stationed at the main exit routes in and out of that country. He could only go by the overland route, the very little used route to the jungle over the mountains. They gave him instructions. He had no choice. Off he went alone. On a journey of many, many days, because it was a remote part of the world, there were no villages around. He just had to walk, walk, walk. He could find water, but there's no food. And as a monk, you cannot take supplies. You have to every morning just get your heart, eat that, and you cannot keep anything for your next day. So he hadn't seen any villages for days. And anyone who's actually walked in that part of the world knows that the mountains are incredibly steep. It's up and down, up and down, up and down. It's very, very tiring. Because he hadn't had eaten for days, he got very, very weak. And soon he got so weak, he thought he wasn't going to make it. He thought that the energy of his body was just too low, and he couldn't make those exertions to climb over the next mountain. And as he was wondering on whether he would survive, he started to contemplate that sometimes in the time of the Buddha, devas would help good monks. So he thought to himself that he was a good monk. He was a good monk. He kept his vinaya very strictly, like a good forest monk. He didn't have any money or things like that. He ate one meal a day. He was a meditator. If the devas would help anyone, they should help a monk like him. That's what he thought. He had only thought that a short time, maybe about 10 or 15 minutes, when he turned a corner in the pub, and there in the middle of the jungle, in a place where he hadn't seen a village for days, let alone a person, stood a Thai man. He said, this Thai man was just standing there silently. He noticed he was well dressed. The sort of dress you'll see in Bangkok. Never in the poor villages of the jungles. Jungle people wear rags. This guy had very nice clothes. He also had one of these tipping carriers. Now the monk is not allowed to ask for alms. So the monk went to him. He wasn't going to ask for anything, even though he was so hungry he thought he might die. But the man put his hands together in answer. It was the gesture, without saying anything, the gesture he wanted to give him alms. And so the man opened up his bowl and presented the bowl to this person. And the man opened up the tipping carrier and labeled it hot rice, very delicious curries and sweets. Again, the sort of food you'd only get from a rich man in Bangkok. For those of the monks who have been over in the jungles, what you get is the very coarse killer rice. And sometimes all you have to get is like a monkey hand. Animals, because that's all they can eat, is hunters. Or maybe a potato, because that's all the food they have in those jungles. Here he had the finest of Bangkok food. And how the heck did that man know that he was coming? He couldn't see him in the distance. He never made any announcement he was arriving. He was walking through the wilderness, and this man suddenly appeared with hot food ready to offer to a monk. This Ajahn Chah couldn't help himself. You're not supposed to say anything to your donors. He said, "Where are you from?" And this man never replied in words. He just with his finger pointed upwards. Now that's the true story of Ajahn Chah was fed by Devas, or a Deva, because that was the only way he could survive a long journey through the jungle. Devas help only if it's absolutely necessary, or if it's to increase the faith of a very scientific young Westerner. Now comes my story. As many of you have heard me describe in the Thai forest tradition, after 5 years as a monk, you are expected to leave your monastery. You take your bowl, your robe, and your mosquito net, and you walk, carrying everything you own. It was a wonderful time of my life. You can imagine it. I tried to pare my possessions down to the minimum before I left. But as you have to carry those things walking, you soon throw even more things away. Within a couple of days, I only had my bowl, spare robe, a little water flask, and your umbrella and mosquito net. That's all I had. That's all I had in the whole world. And I had no responsibilities and no duties. At every crossroad, I could go in any direction. Left, right, forward, back. I was completely free. It was a wonderful time of my life when you literally had no place, few possessions. You felt as light as a bird, just like in the time of the Buddha. It was fantastic times. But you could roam, you could always get some food in the early morning by going on our trip. It was a beautiful thing. You could rest in anywhere. We had mosquito net in the fields, in the jungle, anywhere. It was a beautiful experience of physical freedom. But I was walking in the mountains of the central part of the northeast, in a group of mountains called Phu Pham, which at that time were very undeveloped. There was a road through them, but it was still jungle. And the villages were very far spaced. And as I was walking, I had a good meal that morning. But what I was concerned about was my thirst. My water bottle had run out a long time ago. But I was getting more and more dehydrated. And I could feel that I had a lot of endurance. But I really, really was losing all my fluids. It was a very hot day, warm. And there was no wells or rivers which I could see to get any water. I had a strainer, any well or river or pond would have done. It was jungle, it was usually pretty clean. When I got to the ridge of a hill, and I saw to my relief, there was a small village in the bottom, in a valley. And the village had about 4 or 5 houses. You could tell the village by the number of rooms. And I knew in a village of that size, that in one of the houses would be like a general store. A little room in the front, which would sell things like oil, kerosene, matches, cigarettes of course, and also Pepsis. I'd seen many villages like that. I knew how they worked. And so, standing up at the ridge, I remembered the story of Ajahn Chah. So I said, I am a good monk. I was a good monk. I was keeping my precepts very, very well. When I was a meditator, I was on this journey to understand my mind even more. And I was thinking I could have been a big problem with dehydration. So I said, if there are dangers, this is a test for you. If there are dangers, may I get a Pepsi in that store? Because I need not just water, but some salt as well. So I walked down, and again I was a very restrained monk. I kept my gaze maybe 2 meters in front of me. I never looked to the left or right, nor paused as I walked. And as I walked into that small village, I passed a shop in the corner of my eye. It was one of those shops, which had the kerosene and the candles or whatever else. I knew there was people in there from the corner of my eye, but I never stopped or paused. I never looked around. I continued past it. No one stopped. No one asked me, please stop, we want to give you something. And straight away my heart dropped. No papers. I gave them a tent and they failed. As I thought that, I heard a sound behind me. It was the sound of Nimon Kwa. Nimon Kwa. In Thai, that means a person who wants to give you an offering. So I stopped. I've gone past about 2 meters, that's all. I don't walk fast, I was walking slowly. Not on purpose, just the nature when you're writing. I turned around and there was a woman with an open Pepsi Cola bottle. Now that could have been coincidence. What happened next showed me, one, that the day was exist. Number two, they've got a strong sense of humour. Because another man came out with a second Pepsi. And then a third person came out with a third Pepsi. And then a fourth. And then a fifth. The sixth Pepsi came out from a different person. Then a seventh one came out offering me a seventh Pepsi. And then an eighth one. And then a ninth one came out. And there was a little table outside. Well, they invited me to sit down, and I lined the Pepsis up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. One Pepsi would be a coincidence. 9 Pepsi, that was a miracle. That never happened ever again. And also, for those of you who know Thai culture, 9 is their magic number. When you buy marks to the house, it's always 9. If it's the king, it's 999. If it gives a donation, it's never, like $100, it's always $99. The 9 means prosperity. There I have my 9 prosperous Pepsis. Thank you, David. So I'll never ask again, and now I'll be with us. I just actually couldn't drink 9 Pepsis. I just drank the top of each one so they wouldn't get married. And gave the rest back again so they could also enjoy. I don't know if that convinces you, but at that time, because of the culture of the place, that just does not happen. They will never give 9 Pepsis to people. Because I made that resolution clearly beforehand. It was a test, and the day was came out. Now, so we have what famous words? This is even more recent. About 2 or 3 years ago, it was the 30th anniversary of our Buddhist Society of Western Australia. And, 6 months, 9 months before, our president came up and said, they were 30 years old at Wayset, that we should do some sort of celebration. And I said, yes, let's do one, a big one. Because being a Buddhist in the West for many years, we've always been deliberately quiet. We didn't want to make a big fuss and bother. But now I thought, the time for being quiet is over. We're a very well established part of Australia. We've got about 2% of the population of Buddhists in Australia. That's significant. Why should we be hiding in our small temples? Let's do a big ceremony. And so I was pushing this. And I said to them, let's not go in some back street, let's go in the very centre of Perth. There was a field in the centre of Perth called Supreme Court Gardens. It was a central field, you could call it that. Just right in the middle of the CBD. So I said, let's try that. They said, they'll never hire it to you. Let's give it a try. And the Perth City Council was actually very helpful. They said, yeah, sure, you can hire that. And it was one of these events on Wayside where I told everybody no expense should be spared. It's our 30th anniversary, like a coming of age in Buddhism in Western Australia. Let's give it everything we've got. And so no expense was spared. I got the whole Buddhist community together and we worked so hard to put on a Wayside evening. Some talks followed by a circumambulation around a beautiful Buddha statue which we had shipped in from Thailand specially. Beautiful golden statue. We had our ambassadors coming, TV came, we had the Premier of Western Australia, the head of government there came. But when I woke up that morning, I actually do work very, very hard. I'm not just a teacher of meditation. I also get involved in the management as well, and the building. I'm a very hard working man, so that was my project. I was going to make it work, and I worked really, really hard. But I woke up in the morning, Wayside morning, in our monastery to go very early down to the field to get things started. It was pouring down with rain. An outdoor ceremony that remains that hour is very, very difficult. We rang up the weather forecast. Is it going to stop? No. It's going to rain all day, getting heavier in the evening. The storm was on its way. I said, never mind, we'll go. One of the monks who was with me at the time took me aside and said, listen, I said, Mom, I know you have a lot of faith. But you're crazy. But there's a storm coming. There's no one will come. You make a fool of yourself. Now let's quit where we've got a chance. Let's cancel. And of course I said, no. We're going to go through with this. 3 times that day, the Premier's office, the protocol office, they rang me. Said, are you cancelling? The first time I said, no, I said, okay. The second time, well, you should cancel. Because the weather forecast was getting worse and worse and worse. And 3 times I said, no, we're going ahead. And again, they too thought we were crazy. And our people, they were getting soaked, setting up the tents, setting up the Buddha statue and everything else. It was only a fake kept them going. 6 o'clock, rain dropped. I should have said there was one of my chief supporters. He used to be in the Merchant Navy, a sailor. He also took me aside. And he said, look, I've seen the thermometer readings. It's falling. He said, I know this. I've been a sailor all my life. He'd been retired. He said, a storm is on its way. You haven't seen anything yet, he said. This is dangerous. There's going to be heavy winds, massive rain. it can't be destroyed. I said, of course not. 6 o'clock, it started raining. Even better than that, 6:30. I was in one of the tents. One of the Burmese disciples came in excitedly, crying. I said, well, come out now. As I went down, I could see the clouds parted. And the full Waisak moon was shining over our field. And it stayed out for the whole ceremony, 2 hours. The TV reporter kept on walking around, saying, this is weird. Oh, sorry, eerie, she said. This is eerie. This is eerie. This is eerie. We performed our ceremonies. When we finished, the rain came down. Not many people turned up that night. The premier came. He was very impressed. So was the ambassadors. Not many people came. I found out the following day that to the east of that field, to the west, to the north, to the south, trees were being uprooted by the storm. It was lashing down in all directions. And my supporters could not believe that we performed that ceremony. Because in their suburbs, just a couple of miles away, the storm was raging. I'm not exaggerating, this is absolute truth, no exaggeration. And that night, that field flooded, and so did the freeway. It's the only time it's ever flooded. There was a huge storm came that night, one of the biggest storms in the city. Probably the biggest storm, as far as rainfall is concerned. But it stopped for our waiter. The company provided the tents to us. Send an email to me by another person. At Emperor, can you please tell me who's going to win the horse race tomorrow? That's what they said. They were impressed. Now, Davis will do that for you, but only if it's something really important. I know that other times you say, oh, the rain stopped because it was an important day. But this was not a small thing. This was a huge storm. A huge storm which was all around that central field at the time. But it stopped for us just at the time. And even the clouds parted for the moon to come out. And that really impressed a lot of people and made many people cry.
Yeah.
They were taking that as well, yeah. It's fascinating what Davis can do, but only if you're a good person. So you don't need to ask for this, but actually I did ask for that. So that was the same of other people. But you can only ask that very, very, very rarely. So the Davis are there, but they won't ask you, you know, to make your business go well. They won't answer, you know, can that nice young man fall in love with me? Well, to think about that, forget it. It really is, or, you know, may, you know, my husband's cancer be cured. It has to be something which is selfless, you know, for a big cause. Then the day is gone. So you don't need to go pray for those devils. As long as you're a good, kind person, and it's something really worthwhile you are doing, only then will they help out. They will not get involved in small criticisms. It's the neighbors. They're like big shops. They're real big shops. So, I've talked a lot already. Any comments on that? The neighbors are responsible. Here we go, anyway. When practicing walking meditation, sometimes you feel as if your body becomes small or big. Can you please explain as to how this practice should go? Well, thank you again for that question, because it relates to another question which came up in interview times. When you do meditation, sometimes you see some strange things, you experience some weird perceptions. what actually is happening here, you don't need to be afraid or be scared. When you understand the psychology of perception, you will realize that the way you interpret things in our world is very strictly following a conditioned code. You learn to see according to your teachers, your culture, your education. We only interpret a very, very narrow range of phenomena. In other things, we just can't even achieve them. We perceive in a certain way and no others. When you start to get into deep meditation, you go beyond your conditioning. So much so you can perceive things in unique and original ways. Such strange ways that sometimes you think you're going crazy. Like you're ballooning, your whole body is filling the whole room. You're sinking into the earth. One of my first experiences of this was a very benign experience, but still so strange as to leave me shaking my head afterwards. It was in my monastery in Thailand. I was having some very good meditation. After bathing, I was walking back to my hut when I passed the washing line. There on the line, I saw a towel hanging dry. Only it was a black towel, jet black. I stopped, stared to check my eyes, because I've never in my life, before or since then, seen a towel entirely black in colour. You go to any shop, and towels are brown, white, yellow, pink, blue, but no one has a black towel. And I stared at that for about 3 minutes, looking, what the heck is a black towel doing on our line? And as I watched it after 3 minutes, then it turned into a white towel again. And it was clearly in the light of day. I had my wits about me. I wasn't blind. I wasn't crazy. I'd actually seen a black towel turn back to white again. By the time I thought, that's weird. But later on when I read the sutras, I remember reading that people who can meditate, sometimes they can look at night as if it's day, day as if night. This is the power of the mind. It can change perceptions at will. And it can see the wall which you're leaning against. This melts and completely dissolve. It can see the floor open up or turn into a beautiful series of lights. The perception can do amazing things. What you're doing here is you're freeing the constraints of perception put on by your conditioned upbringing. So perception can just see in different ways. You don't need to be scared when that happens, because it only happens for a short time, then you come back to your normal conditioned ways of looking at things. But I find it fun. There's not many things you can do as a monk for entertainment, but that's one of them. I like weird experiences. I get off on them. And I encourage people, if that happens to you, just enjoy it. It's fun. You'll see something which even Steven Spielberg couldn't create. I call it the meditator playtime. Your perception is clean. Enjoy it. Some teachers say, no, 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 just leave it alone, go back to your breath and go back to an inner. But I find it so safe for myself and for others. I've explored it more, it's safe enough. And it gives you like a payoff. You've been working so hard meditating. Now you get something interesting. Wow, this is really great. You're seeing something really neat. It's not reliable as a source of future information. So you don't believe that this means anything. All it is just the mind playing around. You can enjoy it. It's like playtime like you're at school. Between your math lesson and your next English lesson, you're allowed to go out into the playground with a cricket ball or a soccer ball, and you just play. It's good fun and quite safe. So if those sorts of things happen, you have to be really experienced to get this. Enjoy. It's fun. And after you've had your fun, you can go back to the breath or go back to the limiter and make it more still and steady. Weird stuff. Thank you very much. Now I can go back to work. So the person on the walking path felt themselves as if their body becomes smaller. That's what was happening. That's actually quite innocuous stuff. Wait to get stuff. That's really fun. And don't get afraid. Enjoy. It's nice to do. Nice to get stuff in your meditation. Nice to do. Good. Enjoy. Sometimes that can happen because even at other times your perception can actually be free from its constraints. Especially if he has been meditating or if he's been very tired or whatever. Because remember, the way we look is so conditioned, so habitually taught to look at things in one way. Boy, cup, microphone, and our society and our interactions with other people reinforces that. But sometimes, especially through meditation, we let go of all of those constraints, all those barriers and fences that are still left over. You go and perceive things in other ways. It also makes you very creative. You start to see things in new ways, other people haven't seen before. Literally, because the mind has got 100% freedom. A lot of the stuff, is just completely useless. Who knows? It makes it something. Which will give you a new angle on the problem you're thinking about. Please like this experience with me. Why is it that your talks given to your monastery monks are not distributed freely to the public? Thank you. Yeah, there are some talks. When I talk to my monks, because these are obviously committed practitioners. But it's not that some of the monks are intrinsically hired on lay people, but generally they would be because of their commitment and their 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year practice. You have to go back to work, you have a family to look after, other commitments. So I find actually that when I give a talk, you have to be very careful. If you have too many people there and their practice isn't so good, then actually I find I can't talk deeply. Sometimes people say, "Oh, give us a deep talk, Ajahn," and it just will not come out because people are not ready for it. So if I knew that the talks I gave to my monks were going to be distributed to everybody, I would never be able to give a deep talk. It just will not come out. It's not up to me. Giving the talk is a relationship between myself and my audience. It's not under my control. It's anatta. So, number one, the talk would not be deep if I knew it could be distributed widely. But number two, it's a teaching of the Buddha, which I always remember. This is, the Buddha actually said, you should not teach sila to those without sila. You should not teach samadhi to those who have got no experience of samadhi. You should not teach deep wisdom to those who have only got shallow wisdom. That's a spiritual release. Because if you do that, people just don't understand, they end up criticizing you and arguing with you. And that's their bad karma. So you don't want to encourage people to do bad karma by getting into criticisms of things they just do not understand. So that's why the Buddha himself said, I will not teach sila to people without sila. They said, "Oh, you monks, you're just into, not allowing people to have a good time. You should get real. Live in the 21st century. What do you mean you can't have sort of TVs? Everybody's got to have a TV. Now, what do you mean you can't have sex? You're just repressing your libido. You're deviant. You should go to therapy, you monks." And those are the sorts of things I've heard. here one of my disciples who was trying to keep the fifth precept along with the other precepts. He went to a reception and they offered him some alcohol. He said, "No, I don't drink alcohol, I'm a Buddhist." And they said, "Yes, we understand about Buddhism, it's all about letting go. Come on, let go, have a drink." So you can see the problem there. When you try and teach sila to people who don't keep sila, they end up getting upset at you, they end up getting angry at you, and they're the ones who actually create more bad karma for themselves. Especially with samadhi, it's a very, very subtle teaching. And because they're very subtle, a lot of people just will not understand them. When they don't understand them, they'll start criticizing, scolding. And that's bad. And in particular, the wisdom teachings. These are very, very refined. For me to teach wisdom teachings to you because you've had lots of experience of the Dhamma. If they go far and wide to every Tom, Dick and Harry, they'll be writing me emails and letters, probably to you as well. "These monks, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't mean samadhi. Ajahn Brahm is just described a person going crazy with the perception going all over the place. You should stop that guy, he's dangerous." So be very careful. If any of those talks, if you do have them, they are just for you. If I let you have because I trust you. And if you misplace that trust by giving it to someone else, that is bad karma for you. I don't say that lightly. But trust, especially with a good mind, is important. If you misplace that trust, if I give something to you and I say, "Please don't give it to anyone else," you do give it to someone else. No thanks. Don't give it, please. I don't want you to give it to someone. Next question. What if friends tell you, "If you don't want to drink, that's fine, but why don't you bring it in so that we can have a good time? This is when I have a party at my house." What should I say to them? If you want a good time, then be good. That's obvious, that's logic. You can tell them, "Look, we can have a much better time without drink. I don't want you throwing up on my carpet. I don't want you saying stupid things to my wife. I don't want you just shouting and making a fool of yourself." I remember being a Thai person in a Thai person's house once. They were giving me a dhan. It was actually the representative of Thai Airways in Perth. He just moved into our house and he invited the monks into dhan and to bless the house. And I was talking about the five precepts. And his son, he said, maybe about 8 or 9 years of age. And I was trying to teach his son because, in Western countries, the children are exposed to drugs very early in their life. So I was actually, I said, "Look, that's stupid, when you sort of take alcohol mask. Have you ever seen somebody who's stupid and drunk?" He turned around and said, "Yes, you, my daddy." I was so pleased because the father was so embarrassed in public. Someone else would say that, but the son, because the son is honest, said, "Yeah, my daddy, he's been drunk and stupid." And that really made the father think about his actions. So it's wonderful being scolded by your son, quite innocently. So really, you're in your full rights to say, "This is my house." What you do in your house is your concern. This is my house. And we have a good time here without alcohol. We can actually speak and listen to each other. We're in full control of our faculties. We can enjoy each other's company. And you do have a far, far happier time without alcohol, as I've been saying all the time. And that friend who came to me and told me about the let go, we know about Buddhism. He came back to me afterwards and said, "I found a solution to that problem." Because now when he goes to parties and receptions and someone offers him alcohol, he says, "No, I can't take it. Doctor's orders." And no one ever questions him. because it is not with orders.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
And he never gets into an argument anyway. So when he came and told me, I said, hang on. Now you're keeping one precept, but it may be you're lying. There's nothing wrong with you. I know you're perfectly healthy. And then, you know, I admit my mistake because he corrected me. He said, no, Ajahn Brahm, I'm not lying. You should know, because you taught me this. So what did I teach you? You taught me that in the sutras, the Buddha called himself a doctor. So I'm not big because it's doctor's orders. Doctor Buddha's orders. That's not lying to say doctor's orders, because the Buddha often compared himself to a doctor. You know that. So when you go to a party reception, can't drink doctor's orders, okay.
Dr. Buddha's office.
Get out of there. We've got two more questions here. Venerable Sir, what are your views of the Parasamapatiya, I think that's what it is, and did the Aswaka Mahanama have the chance? Okay, can you please enlighten us on this? I think I've mentioned, I think this morning, about the Parasamapati. I think what they mean here is that in the commentaries and the Abhidharma, there may be this experience too close to a samadhi experience. And they get the two things confused, what's actually samadhi and what's the attainment. So they even call it sometimes, you know, the samadhi of the attainment. That's really, 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 really wrong and very confusing. As I said this morning, to understand what these attainments are, the best metaphor for you is that simile of the shipwrecked sailors. Because that is not theoretical, that is descriptive of how these things actually happen. I never did mention about the Sakadagami, because there is a very wonderful, another analogy of the Buddha, the simile of the axe handle, like the axe handle. He said the person who uses the axe, he doesn't know just how much of the wood of the handle is worn down. He looks at it one day and sees a lot of it has been worn away through use. He never sees it being worn away, but it's worn away gradually, slowly. That's how the fetters are worn away by the Sakadagami. It's a gradual wearing away. Not an event which happens for Sakadagami, but it's a whole process. Like any doctor knows, death is not an event. There's not a time when you say that person is now dead. It just happened. A moment ago they was alive, a moment after they're dead. It's a process which goes on, people say for 2 or 3 minutes, 5 minutes I've heard. Before they're alive, after they're dead, but somewhere in that time, there's some different organs of the body just turned off. They're not working anymore. So, is that my right? Again, there's a process on the event. Okay, that's what I was thinking of anyway. Now, I've actually been with people who've been on the ICU, you've been, seen them die. With the skin, there's a whole sort of the life indicators, which made one by one gradually. When did they actually die? Said, we don't know, you can't say. 5 minutes ago they were alive. Now they're dead. Sometime in between. But they can't say for sure. At that particular moment. It's a process. Which takes time. And it's lovely that you see in the world there are these things called processes. Not events. We like to make it an event. Seeing the Sotoban is an event, Anagam is an event, Arahats is an event, but the second Gam I don't think is an event. So where have we got Paras and Mahapati? Doesn't make sense. All that stuff came from this time. And did the possible upper down spear silly? Five? Oh, okay, yes. I did the five line, first line of five. Oh, that's Hanchawaki. Hanchawaki. My name I have the challenges. Yes. Certainly you would say that after they were practicing with the Buddha for a while they would have those. I don't think they would have had them before, simply because that the Buddha said that you cannot have the Dharma without walking. And then his five disciples weren't walking in the way until he said it. It's an important point. If you're not too hard on the body, you can't get the jhanas. So for those of you who say, I'm going to sit on the floor anyway, I'm not going to just to work with the pain in my back and my legs, that is not the middle path. Do not decide with the Buddha. So sit comfortably. You say, no, I'm going to just work with the pain, I'm just going to endure. That's not anapanasati, what is it? Anapana. Last question. Here's what this is, the last question. Will it be possible for you to come to Sri Lanka to retreat like this at least once in 2 years? Yeah, you know the Buddha said there are some things which are unanswered questions. Like, you know, does the time exist after death or not exist after death? There are some things undeclared. I won't be able to come again this year, but no, we don't know what's going to happen next year. Now, please understand that I do have a huge amount of responsibilities. Now, the major responsibility is my monastery, where I have 20 monks under my guidance, and more coming along. Now, I really do have to look after those. But sometimes I think, well, when I die, what's going to happen next? The most important thing for a monk to do is actually to make more monks. To make sure the sangha is strong. That has to be my number one responsibility. So they always take precedence over teaching lay people. And obviously that I would have a group of nuns as well. And that's also very important to re-establish the female sangha. You don't just do that by re-establishing ordination. What happens after the ordination? The nuns need training and a place to train. They need support. They need the resources. And of course, that's what, you know, I've been very successful so far in Perth, is getting this nuns monastery going. And it's very, very inspiring. But it's tough. You know, I have to be very tough trying not to get too involved so that the nuns there can be independent, not under my umbrella. Because if they're under my umbrella, they don't get the independence and strength to learn from their mistakes, to run their own affairs, and be really an independent women sangha. That's also one of my responsibilities. Also a responsibility for many other states in Australia, and the state of Buddhism in Australia. Now just recently I started the Australian Sangha Association, to try and get all the monks and the nuns of Australia. It's a very ambitious project. Not just Theravada, but Mahayana and also Vajrayana to bend. The Buddhists for goodness sake, let's stick together. And then maybe we can have some influence, some positive influence. Sure, there are many differences between Mahayana, Vajrayana and Theravada, but we all believe in the same Buddha, and precepts, and compassion, and kindness, and meditation. We have enough in common. Let's try and work together. But of course, that's a very, very difficult thing to do, to try and get people to work together from different conditions. But we're getting there, but that's still a lot of work for me to keep that going, build up on the momentum which we started with. And then there's also, I've got a huge group in Singapore, and that's my group. This is called the Buddhist Fellowship. One of their centers is called the Brahm Center, after me. I'm their main teacher and I keep them going. And then I've got these other groups in Malaysia and all over the world, so it's tough for me. So please apologize if I can't come as often as I can. One of the ways of dealing with that, and it's a wonderful solution, is actually to put all of your talks on the internet. And this internet is just such a boon for the Dhamma. Because wherever you go, you can get. Now, fortunately, hopefully next time I come here, we'll have that camera attached to the internet. So the people in Perth can see it. Wherever else in the world, any talk goes straight on the net. And a video streaming. So that people can, wherever in the world you're giving a talk, people can see you and hear the Dhamma. It's not just in Sri Lanka. Now there's people in Iceland, there's people in the middle of Russia, or anywhere else in the world. People actually, Muslims download these books. They're not supposed to, but they do. Because who can stop you in your bedroom? And kids, you know, playing on the internet can download these talks. But because I've got a lot of sharp people in my society, there's a couple of weeks ago they put a couple of my talks on YouTube. Now that really is sort of our young people's area. You know what? Who knows what YouTube is? You know, it's only been going 6 months and Google have bought it for about $2 billion. They know that this is a big thing for the future. Anyone can actually record something and post it on YouTube. Video. You can interact with it. This is the cutting edge, reaching heaps and heaps of people. When you do that, it means the Dhamma is being spread properly. Not just kept in the temple. The temple has to go into the bedroom of your kids. To go into the offices, to go into the cars, to go into the iPods, so when you're jogging along the beach, you're listening to a talk, a Dhamma talk. Or when you're sort of exercising around the church, like Stalin does, and he can also, on his MP3 player, and listen to a Dhamma talk. When you're getting stuck in the traffic on the poor road on the way to work, instead of listening to some stupid music, listen to a Dhamma talk. Some modern age, and how we respond to that modern age will be how Buddhism grows and spreads in this world. We have to keep up. Fortunately, that, you know, some of the Buddhists are way ahead of the other religions. I was very proud of my president because he got interviewed by BBC Channel 4 podcasting, because we were state of the art and one of the first people to do a podcast. So BBC saw that, all the way in London, contacted him, interviewed him for the TV, on a Channel 4 program on podcast. I was very pleased that our little president, he was way up there at the front, growing. So that's how we do it. It's much cheaper to get a good internet connection than it is to build a new temple. So I'm putting resources with it, maybe effective. Okay, there we go, that's it, folks. So, you've had huge input of Dhamma. So I expect many things from you. And if your karma is right, and if you are good meditators, don't argue with each other, don't be proud after the retreat said, what did you get? What did you get? Keep it to yourself. And that way, you don't get into terrible pride and jealousy, which we do have in Sri Lanka. Spiritual pride and spiritual jealousy. That's bad karma. So, keep it for yourself. And I can't keep my attainments to myself. And that way, you can progress much faster, much deeper, with greater harmony. So thank you for listening. I don't need to give a blessing. You've been blessed in the last 4 days. Sorry? I'm not the money. You don't need to give an envelope of money. This is not business. I don't do this for a salary. If the monks expect money after they come to a house, then they should actually pay income tax, because it's a profession. It's not generosity anymore. Do monks pay income tax in Sri Lanka?
No.
But if you want to give a donation, give a donation, but not for coming, not for doing things. I was very impressed in the story of the Buddha when he was on alms round. Remember that wonderful poem where he went to see a farmer as he was dishing out the lunch for the workers? and the Buddha came with his arms folded, and the head father said, "Why should I give any food to you? You've done no work." And the Buddha gave this beautiful poem, I can't remember it completely. He said, "I've sowed my field, I've nurtured my plants, my harvest is in, and now, you know, all of my work is done." He's using his practice as a monk, to arahat, as a metaphor. And the father understood it and said, "Wow, you have done your work. I understand that, you know, you're a good meditator. Thank you so much for that lovely Dharma discourse. Wait here and I will feed you." And the Buddha said, "No. When I give Dharma, I don't give Dharma for food." And the Buddha walked away and fasted that day. Giving Dharma is a gift. You never give Dharma for money or for food. You just give. Donations are not as a result of a monk giving Dharma. You give a donation because it comes from your heart, whether the monk is given or not given. These are separate transactions. You always remember the story of the Buddha. He would not accept money. Not money, but even food, though he was hungry. Because he'd given a Dharma discourse. In a sense, yes, he was giving it to the monk, it is. It's much better to give the donation to the temple.
No, knowing that you are doing the wrong thing, you give the money to the monk.
It's a difficult one because it's better to do it that way. But sometimes you know the situation you are in. It's culturally very difficult to upset people. And I wouldn't criticize the lay person for doing that. It's a problem which will not be solved just by confrontation. It's a problem which will only be solved by education. So in the meantime, maybe you can give that envelope. But please don't give it to good monks, and please try and encourage our monks, you know, to be a bit more unworldly. If your wives or husbands want to listen to it, that's fine. But you know, please understand, don't distribute it far and wide. Don't put it in a big machine and give it to this person, that person. Make sure you only give these talks to people who will appreciate them and understand them, not people who use them as a source of criticism, who have been a bad karma. Only give them a talk on Sila to those who understand Sila, talk on Samadhi to those who understand Samadhi. Talks of hunger on those who understand this. And I have to leave it up to you because you hold the owners of your heart.